But the thing that annoyed me most, well, one day when I happened to pick up a book of hers in the staff room and glanced at the flyleaf, I said, "I'm glad you spell your name with a K. Catherine is so much more alluring than Catherine, just as K is ever so much gypsier a letter than smug C." She made no response, but the next note she sent up was signed Catherine Brooke with a C. I sneezed all the way home. I really would give up trying to be friends with her if I hadn't a queer, unaccountable feeling that under all her brusqueness and aloofness, she is actually starved for companionship. Altogether, what with Catherine's antagonism and the Pringles' attitude, I don't know just what I'd do if it wasn't for dear Rebecca Dew and your letters and little Elizabeth. Because I've got acquainted with little Elizabeth, and she is a darling. 3 nights ago, I took the glass of milk to the wall door, and little Elizabeth herself was there to get it instead of the woman, her head just coming above the solid part of the door so that her face was framed in the ivy. She is small, pale, golden, and wistful. Her eyes, looking at me through the autumn twilight, are large and golden hazel. Her silver-gold hair was parted in the middle, sleeked plainly down over her head with a circular comb, and fell in waves on her shoulders. She wore a pale blue gingham dress and the expression of a princess of Elfland. She had what Rebecca Dew calls a delicate air, and gave me the impression of a child who was more or less undernourished, not in body, but in soul, more of a moonbeam than a sunbeam. "And this is Elizabeth?" I said.
"Not tonight," she answered gravely. "This is my night for being Betty, because I love everything in the world tonight. I was Elizabeth last night, and tomorrow night I'll probably be Beth. It all depends on how I feel."
There was the touch of the kindred spirit for you. I thrilled to it at once. "How very nice to have a name you can change so easily and still feel it's your own." Little Elizabeth nodded.
"I can make so many names out of it. Elsie and Betty and Bess and Eliza and Lisbeth and Beth. But not Lizzie. I can never feel like Lizzie."
"Who could?" I said.
"Do you think it is silly of me, Miss Shirley? Grandmother and the woman do."
"Not silly at all. Very wise and very delightful," I said. Little Elizabeth made saucer eyes at me over the rim of her glass. I felt that I was being weighed in some secret spiritual balance, and presently I realized thankfully that I had not been found wanting. For little Elizabeth asked a favor of me, and little Elizabeth does not ask favors of people she does not like.
"Would you mind lifting up the cat and letting me pat him?" she asked shyly.
Dusty Miller was rubbing against my legs. I lifted him, and little Elizabeth put out a tiny hand and stroked his head delightedly.
"I like kittens better than babies," she said,
looking at me with an odd little air of defiance, as if she knew I would be shocked, but tell the truth she must. "I suppose you've never had much to do with babies, so you don't know how sweet they are," I said, smiling. "Have you a kitten of your own?" Elizabeth shook her head.
"Oh, no. Grandmother doesn't like cats, and the woman hates them. The woman is out tonight, so that is why I could come for the milk. I love coming for the milk, because Rebecca Dew is such an agreeable person."
"Are you sorry she didn't come tonight?" I laughed. Little Elizabeth shook her head.
"No, you are very agreeable, too. I've been wanting to get acquainted with you, but I was afraid it mightn't happen before tomorrow comes."
We stood there and talked while Elizabeth sipped her milk daintily and told me all about tomorrow. The woman told her that tomorrow never comes, but Elizabeth knows better. It will come sometime. Some beautiful morning she will just wake up and find it is tomorrow. Not today, but tomorrow. And then things will happen. Wonderful things. She may even have a day to do exactly as she likes in, with nobody watching her. Though I think Elizabeth feels that is too good to happen even in tomorrow. Or she may find out what is at the end of the harbor road, that wandering, twisting road like a nice red snake that leads, so Elizabeth thinks, to the end of the world. Perhaps the island of happiness is there. Elizabeth feels sure there is an island of happiness somewhere where all the ships that never come back are anchored, and she will find it when tomorrow comes.
And when tomorrow comes, said Elizabeth, I will have 1,000,000 dogs and 45 cats. I told Grandmother that when she wouldn't let me have a kitten, Miss Shirley, and she was angry and said, I'm not accustomed to be spoken to like that, Miss Impertinence. I was sent to bed without supper, but I didn't mean to be impertinent. And I couldn't sleep, Miss Shirley, because the woman told me that she knew a child once that had died in her sleep after being impertinent.
When Elizabeth had finished her milk, there came a sharp tapping at some unseen window behind the spruces. I think we had been watched all the time. My elf maiden ran, her golden head glimmering along the dark spruce aisle until she vanished.
She's a fanciful little creature, said Rebecca Dew when I told her of my adventure.
Really, it somehow had the quality of an adventure, Gilbert.
One day she said to me, Are you scared of lions, Rebecca Dew? I never met any, so I can't tell you, says I. There will be any amount of lions in tomorrow, says she, but they will be nice, friendly lions. Child, you'll turn into eyes if you look like that, says I. She was looking clean through me at something she saw in that tomorrow of hers. I'm thinking deep thoughts, Rebecca Dew, she says. The trouble with that child is she didn't laugh enough.
I remembered Elizabeth had never laughed once during our talk. I feel that she hasn't learned how. The great house is so still and lonely and laughterless. It looks dull and gloomy even now when the world is a riot of autumn color. Little Elizabeth is doing too much listening to lost whispers. I think one of my missions in Summerside will be to teach her how to laugh. Your tenderest, most faithful friend, Anne Shirley. P.S. More of Aunt Shatty's grandmother. Chapter 3. Windy Poplars, Spooks Lane, Summerside, October 25th. Gilbert, dear, what do you think? I've been to supper at Maplehurst. Miss Ellen herself wrote the invitation. Rebecca Dew was really excited. She had never believed they would take any notice of me, and she was quite sure it was not out of friendliness.
They have some sinister motive, that I'm certain of, she exclaimed.
I really had some such feeling in my own mind.
Be sure you put on your best, ordered Rebecca Dew.
So I put on my pretty cream chalice dress with the purple violets in it, and did my hair the new way with the dip in the forehead. It's very becoming. The ladies of Maplehurst are positively delightful in their own way, Gilbert. I could love them if they'd let me. Maplehurst is a proud, exclusive house which draws its trees around it and won't associate with common houses. It has a big white wooden woman off the bow of old Captain Abraham's famous ship, the Go and Ask Her, in the orchard, and billows of southernwood about the front steps, which was brought out from the old country over 100 years ago by the first emigrating Pringle. They have another ancestor who fought at the Battle of Minden, and his sword is hanging on the parlor wall beside Captain Abraham's portrait. Captain Abraham was their father, and they are evidently tremendously proud of him. They have stately mirrors over the old black fluted mantels, a glass case with waxed flowers in it, pictures full of the beauty of the ships of long ago, a hair wreath containing the hair of every known Pringle, big conch shells, and a quilt on the spare room bed, quilted in infinitesimal fans. We sat in the parlor on mahogany Sheraton chairs. It was hung with silver stripe wallpaper. Heavy brocade curtains at the windows, marble-topped tables, one bearing a beautiful model of a ship with crimson hull and snow-white sails, the go-and-ask-her. An enormous chandelier, all glass and dingle-dangles, suspended from the ceiling. A round mirror with a clock in the center, something Captain Abraham had brought home from foreign parts. It was wonderful. I'd like something like it in our house of dreams. The very shadows were eloquent and traditional. Miss Ellen showed me millions, more or less, of Pringle photographs, many of them daguerreotypes in leather cases. A big tortoiseshell cat came in, jumped on my knee, and was at once whisked out to the kitchen by Miss Ellen. She apologized to me, but I expect she had previously apologized to the cat in the kitchen. Miss Ellen did most of the talking. Miss Sarah, a tiny thing in a black silk dress and starched petticoat, with snow-white hair and eyes as black as her dress, thin, veined hands folded on her lap amid fine lace ruffles, sad, lovely, gentle, looked almost too fragile to talk. And yet I got the impression, Gilbert, that every Pringle of the clan, including Miss Ellen herself, danced to her piping. We had a delicious supper. The water was cold, the linen beautiful, the dishes and glassware thin. We were waited on by a maid, quite as aloof and aristocratic as themselves, but Miss Sarah pretended to be a little deaf whenever I spoke to her, and I thought every mouthful would choke me. All my courage oozed out of me. I felt just like a poor fly caught on flypaper. Gilbert, I can never, never conquer or win the royal family. I can see myself resigning at New Year's. I haven't a chance against a clan like that. And yet, I couldn't help feeling a little sorry for the old ladies as I looked around their house. It had once lived. People had been born there, died there, exulted there, known sleep, despair, fear, joy, love, hope, hate, and now it has nothing but the memories by which they live, and their pride in them. Aunt Shatty is much upset because when she unfolded clean sheets for my bed today, she found a diamond-shaped crease in the center. She is sure it foretells a death in the household. Aunt Kate is very much disgusted with such superstition, but I believe I rather like superstitious people. They lend color to life. Wouldn't it be a rather drab world if everybody was wise and sensible and good? What would we find to talk about? We had a catastrophe here 2 nights ago. Dusty Miller stayed out all night, in spite of Rebecca Dew's stentorian shouts of puss in the backyard. And when he turned up in the morning, oh, such a looking cat! One eye was closed completely, and there was a lump as big as an egg on his jaw. His fur was stiff with mud, and one paw was bitten through. But what a triumphant, unrepentant look he had in his one good eye! The widows were horrified. But Rebecca Dew said exultantly, "That cat has never had a good fight in his life before, and I'll bet the other cat looks far worse than he does." A fog is creeping up the harbor tonight, blotting out the red road that little Elizabeth wants to explore. Weeds and leaves are burning in all the town gardens, and the combination of smoke and fog is making Spooks Lane an eerie, fascinating, enchanted place. It is growing late, and my bed says, "I have sleep for you." I've grown used to climbing a flight of steps into bed and climbing down them. Oh, Gilbert, I've never told anyone this, but it's too funny to keep any longer. The first morning I woke up in Windy Poplars, I forgot all about the steps and made a blithe morning spring out of bed. I came down like a thousand of bricks, as Rebecca Dew would say. Luckily, I didn't break any bones, but I was black and blue for a week. Little Elizabeth and I are very good friends by now. She comes every evening for her milk, because the woman is laid up with what Rebecca Dew calls brown kites. I always find her at the wall gate, waiting for me, her big eyes full of twilight. We talk with the gate, which has never been opened for years, between us. Elizabeth sips the glass of milk as slowly as possible in order to spin our conversation out. Always, when the last drop is drained, comes the tap-tap on the window. I have found that one of the things that is going to happen in tomorrow is that she will get a letter from her father. She had never got one. I wonder what the man can be thinking of.
You know, he couldn't bear the sight of me, Miss Shirley, she told me. But he mightn't mind writing to me.
Who told you he couldn't bear the sight of you? I asked indignantly.
The woman?
Always when Elizabeth says the woman, I can see her like a great big forbidding W, all angles and corners.
And it must be true, or he would come to see me sometimes.
She was Beth that night, and it is only when she is Beth that she will talk of her father. When she is Beth, she makes faces at her grandmother and the woman behind their backs. But when she turns into Elsie, she is sorry for it and thinks she ought to confess, but is scared to. Very rarely, she is Elizabeth, and then she has the face of one who listens to fairy music and knows what roses and clovers talk about. She's the quaintest thing, Gilbert, as sensitive as one of the leaves of the windy poplars, and I love her. It infuriates me to know that those two terrible old women make her go to bed in the dark.
The woman said I was big enough to sleep without a light, but I feel so small, Miss Shirley, because the night is so big and awful, and there is a stuffed crow in my room, and I am afraid of it. The woman told me it would pick my eyes out if I cried. Of course, Miss Shirley, I don't believe that, but still I'm scared. Things whisper so to each other at night. But in tomorrow, I'll never be scared of anything, not even of being kidnapped.
But there is no danger of your being kidnapped, Elizabeth.
The woman said there was if I went anywhere alone or talked to strange persons. But you're not a strange person, are you, Miss Shirley?
No, darling. We've always known each other in tomorrow, I said. Chapter 4 Windy Poplars, Spooks Lane, Summerside, November 10th. Dearest, it used to be that the person I hated most in the world was the person who spoiled my pen nib. But I can't hate Rebecca Dew in spite of her habit of using my pen to copy recipes when I'm in school. She's been doing it again, and as a result, you won't get a long or a loving letter this time. Belovedest. The last cricket song has been sung. The evenings are so chilly now that I have a small, chubby, oblong wood stove in my room. Rebecca Dew put it up. I forgive her the pen for it. There's nothing that woman can't do, and she always has a fire lighted for me in it when I come home from school. It is the tiniest of stoves. I could pick it up in my hands. It looks just like a pert little black dog on its four bandy iron legs. But when you fill it with hardwood sticks, it blooms rosy red and throws a wonderful heat, and you can't think how cozy it is. I'm sitting before it now, with my feet on its tiny hearth, scribbling to you on my knee. Everyone else in Summerside, more or less, is at the Hardy Pringles dance. I was not invited, and Rebecca Dew was so cross about it that I'd hate to be Dusty Miller. But when I think of Hardy's daughter Myra, beautiful and brainless, trying to prove in an examination paper that the angels at the base of an isosceles triangle are equal, I forgive the entire Pringle clan. And last week, she included gallows tree quite seriously in a list of trees. But, to be just, all the howlers don't originate with the Pringles. Blake Fenton defined an alligator recently as a large kind of insect. Such are the highlights of a teacher's life. It feels like snow tonight. I like an evening when it feels like snow. The wind is blowing in turret and tree and making my cozy room seem even cozier. The last golden leaf will be blown from the aspens tonight. I think I've been invited to supper everywhere by now. I mean to the homes of all my pupils, both in town and country. And oh, Gilbert, darling, I am so sick of pumpkin preserves. Never, never let us have pumpkin preserves in our house of dreams. Almost everywhere I've gone for the last month, I've had PP for supper. The first time I had it, I loved it. It was so golden that I felt I was eating preserved sunshine, and I incautiously raved about it. It got bruited about that I was very fond of PP, and people had it on purpose for me. Last night I was going to Mr. Hamilton's, and Rebecca Dew assured me that I wouldn't have to eat PP there because none of the Hamiltons liked it. But when we sat down to supper, there on the sideboard was the inevitable cut glass bowl of PP. "I hadn't any pumpkin preserves of my own," said Mrs. Hamilton, ladling me out a generous dishful.
"But I heard you was terrible partial to it. So when I was to my cousin's in Lowvales last Sunday, I says to her, 'I'm having Miss Shirley to supper this week, and she's terrible partial to pumpkin preserves. I wish you'd lend me a jar for her.' So she did, and here it is, and you can take home what's left."
You should have seen Rebecca Dew's face when I arrived home from the Hamiltons bearing a glass jar two-thirds full of PP. Nobody likes it here, so we buried it darkly at dead of night in the garden.
"You won't put this in a story, will you?" she asked anxiously.
Ever since Rebecca Dew discovered that I do an occasional bit of fiction for the magazines, she has lived in the fear, or hope, I don't know which, that I'll put everything that happens at Windy Poplar's into a story. She wants me to
write up the Pringles and blister 'em.
But alas, it's the Pringles that are doing the blistering, and between them and my work in school, I have scant time for writing fiction. There are only withered leaves and frosted stems in the garden now. Rebecca Dew has done the standard roses up in straw and potato bags, and in the twilight they look exactly like a group of humped-back old men leaning on staffs. I got a postcard from Davy today with 10 kisses crossed on it, and a letter from Priscilla written on some paper that a friend of hers in Japan sent her. Silky thin paper, with dim cherry blossoms on it like ghosts. I'm beginning to have my suspicions about that friend of hers. But your big fat letter was the purple gift the day gave me. I read it 4 times over to get every bit of its savor, like a dog polishing off a plate. That certainly isn't a romantic simile, but it's the one that just popped into my head. Still, letters, even the nicest, aren't satisfactory. I want to see you. I'm glad it's only 5 weeks to Christmas holidays. Chapter 5. Anne, sitting at her tower window one late November evening, with her pen at her lip and dreams in her eyes, looked out on a twilight world and suddenly thought she would like a walk to the old graveyard. She had never visited it yet, preferring the birch and maple grove or the harbor road for her evening rambles. But there is always a November space after the leaves have fallen when she felt it was almost indecent to intrude on the woods, for their glory terrestrial had departed, and their glorial celestial of spirit and purity and whiteness had not yet come upon them. So Anne betook herself to the graveyard instead. She was feeling for the time so dispirited and hopeless that she thought a graveyard would be a comparatively cheerful place. Besides, it was full of Pringles, so Rebecca Dew said. They had buried there for generations, keeping it up in preference to the new graveyard until no more of them could be squeezed in. Anne felt that it would be positively encouraging to see how many Pringles were where they couldn't annoy anybody anymore. In regard to the Pringles, Anne felt that she was at the end of her tether. More and more, the whole situation was coming to seem like a nightmare. The subtle campaign of insubordination and disrespect which Jen Pringle had organized had at last come to a head. One day, a week previously, she had asked the seniors to write a composition on the most important happenings of the week. Jen Pringle had written a brilliant one. The little imp was clever. And had inserted in it a sly insult to her teacher, one so pointed that it was impossible to ignore it. Anne had sent her home, telling her that she would have to apologize before she would be allowed to come back. The fat was fairly in the fire. It was open warfare now between her and the Pringles, and poor Anne had no doubt on whose banner victory would perch. The school board would back the Pringles up, and she would be given her choice between letting Jen come back or being asked to resign. She felt very bitter. She had done her best, and she knew she could have succeeded if she had had even a fighting chance.
"It's not my fault," she thought miserably. "Who could succeed against such a phalanx and such tactics?"
But to go home to Green Gables defeated, to endure Mrs. Lynde's indignation and the Pyes' exultation, even the sympathy of friends would be an anguish. And with her Summerside failure bruited abroad, she would never be able to get another school. But at least they had not got the better of her in the matter of the play. Anne laughed a little wickedly, and her eyes filled with mischievous delight over the memory. She had organized a high school dramatic club and directed it in a little play, hurriedly gotten up to provide some funds for one of her pet schemes, buying some good engravings for the rooms. She had made herself ask Catherine Brooke to help her, because Catherine always seemed so left out of everything. She could not help regretting it many times, for Catherine was even more brusque and sarcastic than usual. She seldom let a practice pass without some corrosive remark, and she overworked her eyebrows. Worse still, it was Catherine who had insisted on having Jen Pringle take the part of Mary, Queen of Scots.
"There's no one else in the school who can play it," she said impatiently. "No one who has the necessary personality."
Anne was not so sure of this. She rather thought that Sophie Sinclair, who was tall and had hazel eyes and rich chestnut hair, would make a far better Queen Mary than Jen. But Sophie was not even a member of the club and had never taken part in a play.
"We don't want absolute greenhorns in this. I'm not going to be associated with anything that is not successful,"
Catherine had said disagreeably, and Anne had yielded. She could not deny that Jen was very good in the part. She had a natural flair for acting, and she apparently threw herself into it wholeheartedly. They practiced 4 evenings a week, and on the surface things went along very smoothly. Jen seemed to be so interested in her part that she behaved herself as far as the play was concerned. Anne did not meddle with her, but left her to Catherine's coaching. Once or twice, though, she surprised a certain look of sly triumph on Jen's face that puzzled her. She could not guess just what it meant. One afternoon, soon after the practices had begun, Anne found Sophie Sinclair in tears in a corner of the girls' coat room. At first she had blinked her hazel eyes vigorously and denied it, then broke down.
"I did so want to be in the play, to be Queen Mary," she sobbed. "I've never had a chance. Father wouldn't let me join the club because there are dues to pay and every cent counts so much. And of course I haven't had any experience. I've always loved Queen Mary. Her very name just thrills me to my fingertips. I don't believe, I never will believe she had anything to do with murdering Darnley. It would have been wonderful to fancy I was she for a little while."
Afterwards, Anne concluded that it was her guardian angel who prompted her reply. "I'll write the part out for you, Sophie, and coach you in it. It will be good training for you. And, as we plan to give the play in other places, if it goes well here, it will be just as well to have an understudy in case Jen shouldn't always be able to go. But we'll say nothing about it to anyone." Sophie had the part memorized by the next day. She went home to Windy Poplar's with Anne every afternoon when school came out and rehearsed it in the tower. They had a lot of fun together, for Sophie was full of quiet vivacity. The play was to be put on the last Friday in November in the town hall. It was widely advertised, and the reserved seats were sold to the last one. Anne and Catherine spent 2 evenings decorating the hall. The band was hired, and a noted soprano was coming up from Charlottetown to sing between the acts. The dress rehearsal was a success. Jen was really excellent, and the whole cast played up to her. Friday morning, Jen was not in school, and in the afternoon her mother sent word that Jen was ill with a very sore throat. They were afraid it was tonsillitis. Everybody concerned was very sorry, but it was out of the question that she should take part in the play that night. Catherine and Anne stared at each other, drawn together for once in their common dismay.
"We'll have to put it off," said Catherine slowly, "and that means failure. Once we're into December, there's so much going on. Well, I always thought it was foolish to try to get up a play this time of the year."
"We are not going to postpone it," said Anne, her eyes as green as Jen's own.
She was not going to say it to Catherine Brooke, but she knew as well as she had ever known anything in her life that Jen Pringle was no more in danger of tonsillitis than she was. It was a deliberate device, whether any of the other Pringles were a party to it or not, to ruin the play, because she and Shirley had sponsored it.
"Yeah, if you feel that way about it," said Catherine with a nasty shrug. "But what do you intend to do? Get someone to read the part? That would ruin it. Mary is the whole play."
"Sophie Sinclair can play the part as well as Jan. The costume will fit her, and thanks be, you made it and have it, not Jen." The play was put on that night before a packed audience. A delighted Sophie played Mary, was Mary, as Jen Pringle could never have been, looked Mary in her velvet robes and ruff and jewels. Students of Summerside High, who had never seen Sophie in anything but her plain, dowdy, dark serge dresses, shapeless coat and shabby hats, stared at her in amazement. It was insisted on the spot that she become a permanent member of the dramatic club, and herself paid the membership fee, and from then on she was one of the pupils who counted in Summerside High. But nobody knew or dreamed, Sophie herself least of all, that she had taken the first step that night on a pathway that was to lead to the stars. 20 years later, Sophie Sinclair was to be one of the leading actresses in America. But probably no plaudits ever sounded so sweet in her ears as the wild applause amid which the curtain fell that night in Summerside Town Hall. Mrs. James Pringle took a tale home to her daughter Jen, which would have turned that damsel's eyes green if they had not already been so. For once, as Rebecca Dhu said feelingly, Jen had got her comeuppance. And the eventual result was the insult in the composition on Important Happenings. Anne went down to the old graveyard along a deep rutted lane between high, mossy stone dikes, tasseled with frosted ferns. Slim pointed Lombardies, from which November winds had not yet stripped all the leaves, grew along it at intervals, coming out darkly against the amethyst of the far hills. But the old graveyard, with half its tombstones leaning at a drunken slant, was surrounded by a four-square row of tall, somber fir trees. Anne had not expected to find anyone there, and was a little taken aback when she met Miss Valentine Cortelot. With her long, delicate nose, her thin, delicate mouth, her sloping, delicate shoulders, and her general air of invincible ladylikeness, just inside the gate. She knew Miss Valentine, of course, as did everyone in Summerside. She was the local dressmaker, and what she didn't know about people living or dead was not worth taking into account. Anne had wanted to wander about by herself, read the odd old epitaphs, and puzzle out the names of forgotten lovers under the lichens that were growing over them. But she could not escape when Miss Valentine slipped an arm through hers and proceeded to do the honors of the graveyard, where there were evidently as many Cortelots buried as Pringles. Miss Valentine had not a drop of Pringle blood in her, and one of Anne's favorite pupils was her nephew. So it was no great mental strain to be nice to her, except that one must be very careful never to hint that she sewed for a living. Miss Valentine was said to be very sensitive on that point.
"I'm glad I happened to be here this evening," said Miss Valentine. "I can tell you about everybody buried here. I always say you have to know the ins and outs of the corpses to find a graveyard really enjoyable. I like a walk here better than in the new. It's only the old families that are buried here, but every Tom, Dick, and Harry is being buried in the new. The Cortelots are buried in this corner. My, we've had a terrible lot of funerals in our family."
"I suppose every old family has," said Anne, because Miss Valentine evidently expected her to say something.
"Don't tell me any family has ever had as many as ours," said Miss Valentine jealously. "We're very consumptive. Most of us died of a cough. This is my Aunt Bessie's grave. She was a saint, if ever there was one. But there's no doubt her sister, Aunt Cecilia, was the more interesting to talk to. The last time I ever saw her, she said to me, 'Sit down, my dear, sit down.' I'm going to die tonight at 11:10, but that's no reason why we shouldn't have a real good gossip for the last. The strange thing, Miss Shirley, is that she did die that night at 11:10. Can you tell me how she knew it?
Anne couldn't.
My great-great-grandfather Cortelow is buried here. He came out in 1760, and he made spinning wheels for a living. I've heard he made 1,400 in the course of his life. When he died, the minister preached from the text, "Their works do follow them," and old Myron Pringle said in that case the road to heaven behind my great-great-grandfather would be choked with spinning wheels. Do you think such a remark was in good taste, Miss Shirley?
Had anyone but a Pringle said it, Anne might not have remarked so decidedly, "I certainly do not," looking at a gravestone adorned with a skull and crossbones, as if she questioned the good taste of that also.
"My cousin Dora is buried here. She had three husbands, but they all died very rapidly. Poor Dora didn't seem to have any luck picking a healthy man. Her last one was Benjamin Banning, not buried here, buried in Lowvale beside his first wife, and he wasn't reconciled to dying. Dora told him he was going to a better world. 'Maybe, maybe,' says poor Ben, 'but I'm sort of used to the imperfections of this one.' He took 61 different kinds of medicine, but in spite of that, he lingered for a good while. All Uncle David Cortelow's family are here. There's a cabbage rose planted at the foot of every grave, and my, don't they bloom. I come here every summer and gather them for my rose jar. It would be a pity to let them go to waste, don't you think?"
I suppose so.
"My poor young sister Harriet lies here," sighed Miss Valentine. "She had magnificent hair, about the color of yours, not so red, perhaps. It reached to her knees. She was engaged when she died. They tell me you're engaged. I never much wanted to be married, but I think it would have been nice to be engaged. Oh, I've had some chances, of course. Perhaps I was too fastidious. But a Cortelow couldn't marry everybody, could she?"
It did not seem likely she could.
"Frank Digby, over in that corner under the sumacs, wanted me. I did feel a little regretful over refusing him, but a Digby, my dear. He married Georgina Troop. She always went to church a little late to show off her clothes. My, she was fond of clothes. She was buried in such a pretty blue dress. I made it for her to wear to a wedding, but in the end she wore it to her own funeral. She had three darling little children. They used to sit in front of me at church, and I always gave them candy. Do you think it wrong to give children candy in church, Miss Shirley? Not peppermints, that would be all right. There's something religious about peppermints, don't you think? But the poor things don't like them."
When the Cortelow's plots were exhausted, Miss Valentine's reminiscences became a bit spicier. It did not make so much difference if you weren't a Cortelow.
"Old Mrs. Russell Pringle is here. I often wonder if she's in heaven or not."
"But why?" gasped a rather shocked Anne.
"Well, she always hated her sister Mary Ann, who had died a few months before. 'If Mary Ann is in heaven, I won't stay there,' says she. And she was a woman who always kept her word, my dear. Pringle-like. She was born a Pringle and married her cousin Russell. This is Mrs. Dan Pringle, Janetta Bird, 72 a day when she died. Folks say she would have thought it wrong to die a day older than 80, because that is the Bible limit. People do say such funny things, don't they? I've heard that dying was the only thing she ever dared do without asking her husband. Do you know, my dear, what he did once when she bought a hat he didn't like?"
"I can't imagine."
"He ate it," said Miss Valentine solemnly. "Of course, it was only a small hat. Lace and flowers. No feathers. Still, it must have been rather indigestible. I understand he had gnawing pains in his stomach for quite a time. Of course, I didn't see him eat it, but I've always been assured the story was true. Do you suppose it was?"
"I'd believe anything of a Pringle," said Anne bitterly. Miss Valentine pressed her arm sympathetically.
"I feel for you, indeed I do. It's terrible the way they're treating you. But Summerside isn't all Pringle, Miss Shirley."
"Sometimes I think it is," said Anne with a rueful smile.
"No, it isn't, and there are plenty of people who would like to see you get the better of them. Don't you give in to them, no matter what they do. It's just the old Satan that's got into them. But they hang together so, and Miss Sarah did want that cousin of theirs to get the school. The Nathan Pringles are here. Nathan always believed his wife was trying to poison him, but he didn't seem to mind. He said it made life kind of exciting. Once he kind of suspected she'd put arsenic in his porridge, he went out and fed it to a pig. The pig died 3 weeks afterwards, but he said maybe it was only a coincidence, and anyway he couldn't be sure it was the same pig. In the end, she died before him, and he said she'd always been a real good wife to him except for that one thing. I think it would be charitable to believe that he was mistaken about it.
"Sacred to the memory of Miss Kinsey," read Anne in amazement. "What an extraordinary inscription. Had she no other name?"
"If she had, nobody ever knew it," said Miss Valentine. "She came from Nova Scotia and worked for the George Pringles for 40 years. She gave her name as Miss Kinsey, and everybody called her that. She died suddenly, and then it was discovered that nobody knew her first name, and she had no relations that anybody could find. So they put that on her stone. The George Pringles buried her very nicely and paid for the monument. She was a faithful, hard-working creature, but if you'd ever seen her, you'd have thought that she was born Miss Kinsey. The James Morleys are here. I was at their golden wedding. Such a to-do. Gifts and speeches and flowers, and their children all home, and them smiling and bowing and just hating each other as hard as they could."
"Hating each other?"
"Bitterly, my dear. Everyone knew it. They had for years and years, almost all their married life, in fact. They quarreled on the way home from church after the wedding. I often wonder how they managed to lie here so peaceably side by side."
Again Anne shivered. How terrible, sitting opposite each other at table, lying down beside each other at night, going to church with their babies to be christened, and hating each other through it all. Yet they must have loved to begin with. Was it possible she and Gilbert could ever— Nonsense. The Pringles were getting on her nerves.
"Handsome John McTabb is buried here. He was always suspected of being the reason why Annetta Kennedy drowned herself. The McTabbs were all handsome, but you could never believe a word they said. There used to be a stone here for his uncle Samuel, who was reported drowned at sea 50 years ago. When he turned up alive, the family took the stone down. The man they bought it from wouldn't take it back, so Mrs. Samuel used it for a baking board. Talk about a marble slab for mixing on. That old tombstone was just fine, she said. The McTabb children were always bringing cookies to school with raised letters and figures on them, scraps of the epitaph. They gave them away real generous, but I could never bring myself to eat one. I'm peculiar that way. Mr. Harley Pringle is here. He had to wheel Peter McTabb down Main Street once in a wheelbarrow wearing a bonnet for an election bet. All Summerside turned out to see it, except the Pringles. Of course, they nearly died of shame. Millie Pringle is here. I was very fond of Millie, even if she was a Pringle. She was so pretty and as light-footed as a fairy. Sometimes I think, my dear, on nights like this, she must slip out of her grave and dance like she used to. But I suppose a Christian shouldn't be harboring such thoughts. This is Herb Pringle's grave. He was one of the jolly Pringles. He always made you laugh. He laughed right out in church once, when the mouse dropped out of the flowers on Meta Pringle's hat when she bowed in prayer. I didn't feel much like laughing. I didn't know where the mouse had gone. I pulled my skirts tight about my ankles and held them there until church was out, but it spoiled the sermon for me. Herb sat behind me, and such a shout he gave. People who couldn't see the mouse thought he'd gone crazy. It seemed to me that laugh of his couldn't die. If he was alive, he'd stand up for you, Sarah or no Sarah. This, of course, is Captain Abraham Pringle's monument. It dominated the whole graveyard. 4 receding platforms of stone formed a square pedestal, on which rose a huge pillar of marble, topped with a ridiculous draped urn, beneath which a fat cherub was blowing a horn.
"How ugly," said Anne candidly.
"Oh, do you think so?" Miss Valentine seemed rather shocked. "It was thought very handsome when it was erected. That is supposed to be Gabriel blowing his trumpet. I think it gives quite a touch of elegance to the graveyard. It cost $900. Captain Abraham was a very fine old man. It is a great pity he is dead. If he was living, they wouldn't be persecuting you the way they are. I don't wonder Sarah and Ellen are proud of him. though I think they carry it a bit too far.
At the graveyard gate, Anne turned and looked back. A strange, peaceful hush lay over the windless land. Long fingers of moonlight were beginning to pierce the darkling firs, touching a gravestone here and there and making strange shadows among them. But the graveyard wasn't a sad place, after all. Really, the people in it seemed alive after Miss Valentine's tales.
"I've heard you right," said Miss Valentine anxiously as they went down the lane. "You won't put the things I've told you in your stories, will you?"
"You may be sure I won't," promised Anne.
"Do you think it is really wrong, or dangerous, to speak ill of the dead?"
whispered Miss Valentine a bit anxiously.
"I don't suppose it's exactly either," said Anne. "Only rather unfair, like hitting those who can't defend themselves. But you didn't say anything very dreadful of anybody, Miss Cortelow."
"I told you Nathan Pringle thought his wife was trying to poison him."
"But you gave her the benefit of the doubt."
And Miss Valentine went on her way reassured.
Chapter 6. "I wended my way to the graveyard this evening," wrote Anne to Gilbert after she got home. "I think wend your way is a lovely phrase, and I work it in whenever I can. It sounds funny to say I enjoyed my stroll in the graveyard, but I really did. Miss Cortelow's stories were so funny. Comedy and tragedy are so mixed up in life, Gilbert. The only thing that haunts me is the tale of the two who lived together 50 years and hated each other all that time. I can't believe they really did. Somebody has said that hate is only love that has missed its way. I feel sure that under the hatred they really loved each other, just as I really loved you all those years I thought I hated you, and I think death would show it to them. I'm glad I found out in life. And I have found out there are some decent Pringles. Dead ones. Last night, when I went down for a drink of water, I found Aunt Kate buttermilking her face in the pantry. She asked me not to tell Shatty. She would think it so silly. I promised I wouldn't. Elizabeth still comes for the milk, though the woman is pretty well over her bronchitis. I wonder they let her, especially since old Mrs. Campbell is a Pringle. Last Saturday night, Elizabeth—she was Betty that night, I think—ran in singing when she left me, and I distinctly heard the woman say to her at the porch door, 'It's too near the Sabbath for you to be singing that song.' I am sure that woman would prevent Elizabeth from singing on any day if she could." Elizabeth had on a new dress that night, a dark wine color. They do dress her nicely. And she said wistfully,
"I thought I looked a little bit pretty when I put it on tonight, Miss Shirley, and I wished Father could see me. Of course he will see me in tomorrow, but it sometimes seems so slow in coming. I wish we could hurry time a bit, Miss Shirley."
"Now, dearest, I must work out some geometrical exercises. Geometry exercises have taken the place of what Rebecca calls my literary efforts. The specter that haunts my daily path now is the dread of an exercise popping up in class that I can't do."
"And what would the Pringles say then?"
"Oh, then, oh, what would the Pringles say then? Meanwhile, as you love me and the cat tribe, pray for a poor, broken-hearted, ill-used Thomas cat. A mouse ran over Rebecca Dew's foot in the pantry the other day, and she has fumed ever since."
"The cat does nothing but eat and sleep and let mice overrun everything. This is the last straw."
"So she chivies him from pillar to post, routs him off his favorite cushion, and, I know, for I caught her at it, assists him none too gently with her foot when she lets him out."
Chapter 7.
One Friday evening, at the end of a mild, sunny December day, Anne went out to Lowvale to attend a turkey supper. Wilfred Bryce's home was in Lowvale, where he lived with an uncle, and he had asked her shyly if she would go out with him after school, go to the turkey supper in the church, and spend Saturday at his home. Anne agreed, hoping that she might be able to influence the uncle to let Wilfred keep on going to high school.
Wilfrid was afraid that he would not be able to go back after New Year. He was a clever, ambitious boy, and Anne felt a special interest in him. It could not be said that she enjoyed her visit overmuch, except in the pleasure it gave Wilfrid. His uncle and aunt were a rather odd and uncouth pair. Sunday morning was windy and dark, with showers of snow, and at first Anne wondered how she was going to put in the day. She felt tired and sleepy after the late hours of the turkey supper. Wilfrid had to help thrash, and there was not even a book in sight. Then she thought of the battered old seaman's chest she had seen in the back of the hall upstairs, and recalled Mrs. Stanton's request. Mrs. Stanton was writing a history of Prince County, and had asked Anne if she knew of or could find any old diaries or documents that might be helpful.
"The Pringles, of course, have lots that I could use," she told Anne, "but I can't ask them. You know the Pringles and Stantons have never been friends."
"I can't ask them either, unfortunately," said Anne.
"Oh, I'm not expecting you to. All I want is for you to keep your eyes open when you are visiting round in other people's homes, and if you find or hear of any old diaries or maps or anything like that, try to get the loan of them for me. You've no idea what interesting things I found in old diaries, little bits of real life that make the old pioneers live again. I want to get things like that for my book, as well as statistics and genealogical tables."
Anne asked Mrs. Bryce if they had any such old records. Mrs. Bryce shook her head.
"Not as I knows on. And course," brightening up, "there's old Uncle Andy's chest up there. Might be something in it. He used to sail with old Cap'n Abraham Pringle. I'll go out and ask Duncan if ye can root in it."
Duncan sent word back that she could root in it all she liked, and if she found any documents, she could have them. He'd been meaning to burn the hull contents anyway and take the chest for a toolbox. Anne accordingly rooted, but all she found was an old yellow diary or log, which Andy Bryce seemed to have kept all through his years at sea. Anne beguiled the stormy forenoon away by reading it with great interest and amusement. Andy was learned in sea lore, and had gone on many voyages with Captain Abraham Pringle, whom he evidently admired immensely. The diary was full of ill-spelled, ungrammatical tributes to the captain's courage and resourcefulness, especially in one wild enterprise, a beating round the horn. But his admiration had not, it seemed, extended to Abraham's brother Myram, who was also a captain but of a different ship.
"Up to Myram Pringle's tonight. His wife made him mad, and he up and throwed a glass of water in her face. Myram is home. His ship was burned, and they took to the boats. Nearly starved. In the end, they ate up Jonas Selkirk, who had shot himself. They lived on him till the Mary G. picked him up. Myram told me this himself. Seemed to think it a good joke."
Anne shivered over this last entry, which seemed all the more horrifying for Andy's unimpassioned statement of the grim facts. Then she fell into a reverie. There was nothing in the book that could be of any use to Mrs. Stanton. But wouldn't Miss Sarah and Miss Ellen be interested in it, since it contained so much about their adored father? Suppose she sent it to them. Duncan Bryce had said she could do as she liked with it. No, she wouldn't. Why should she try to please them or cater to their absurd pride, which was great enough now without any more food? They had set themselves to drive her out of the school, and they were succeeding. They and their clan had beaten her. Wilfrid took her back to Windy Poplar's that evening, both of them feeling happy. Anne had talked Duncan Bryce into letting Wilfrid finish out his year in high school.
"Then I'll manage Queens for a year, and after that teach and educate myself," said Wilfrid. "How can I ever repay you, Miss Shirley? Uncle wouldn't have listened to anyone else, but he likes you. He said to me out in the barn, red-haired women could always do what they liked with me. But I don't think it was your hair, Miss Shirley, though it is so beautiful. It was just you."
At 2 o'clock that night, Anne woke up and decided she would send Andy Bryce's diary to Maplehurst. After all, she had a bit of liking for the old ladies, and they had so little to make life warm. Only their pride in their father. At 3 she woke again and decided she wouldn't. Miss Sarah pretending to be deaf indeed. At 4, she was in the Swithers again. Finally, she determined she would send it to them. she wouldn't be petty. Anne had a horror of being petty, like the pies. Having settled this, Anne went to sleep for keeps, thinking how lovely it was to wake up in the night and hear the first snowstorm of the winter around your tower and then snuggle down in your blankets and drift into dreamland again. Monday morning, she wrapped up the old diary carefully and sent it to Miss Sarah with a little note. "Dear Miss Pringle, I wonder if you would be interested in this old diary. Mr. Bryce gave it to me for Mrs. Stanton, who is writing a history of the county, but I don't think it would be of any use to her, and I thought you might like to have it. Yours sincerely, Anne Shirley." That's a horribly stiff note, thought Anne, but I can't write naturally to them, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they sent it haughtily back to me. In the fine blue of the early winter evening, Rebecca Dew got the shock of her life. The Maplehurst carriage drove along Spook's Lane over the powdery snow and stopped at the front gate. Miss Ellen got out of it, and then, to everyone's amazement, Miss Sarah, who had not left Maplehurst for 10 years.
"They're coming to the front door,"
gasped Rebecca Dew, panic-stricken.
"Where else would a Pringle come to?" said Aunt Kate.
Of course, but it sticks," said Rebecca tragically. "It does stick, you know it does. And it hasn't been open since we house cleaned last spring. This is the last straw."
The front door did stick, but Rebecca Dew wrenched it open with desperate violence and showed the Maplehurst ladies into the parlor.
"Thank heaven we've had a fire in it today," she thought. "And all I hope is that cat hasn't haired up the sofa. If Sarah Pringle got cat hairs on her dress in our parlor..."
Rebecca Dew dared not imagine the consequences. She called Anne from the tower room, Miss Sarah having asked if Miss Shirley were in, and then betook herself to the kitchen, half mad with curiosity as to what on earth was bringing the old Pringle girls to see Miss Shirley.
"If there's any more persecution in the wind," said Rebecca Dew darkly.
Anne herself descended with considerable trepidation. Had they come to return the diary with icy scorn? It was little, wrinkled, inflexible Miss Sarah who rose and spoke without preamble when Anne entered the room.
"We have come to capitulate," she said bitterly. "We can do nothing else. Of course you knew that when you found that scandalous entry about poor Uncle Myram. It wasn't true. It couldn't be true. Uncle Myram was just taking a rise out of Andy Bryce. Andy was so credulous. But everybody outside of our family will be glad to believe it. You knew it would make us all a laughingstock, and worse. Oh, you are very clever. We admit that. Jen will apologize and behave herself in future. I, Sarah Pringle, assure you of that. If you will only promise not to tell Mrs. Stanton, not to tell anyone, we will do anything. Anything."
Anne stared in amazement and horror. The poor old darlings, they thought she had been threatening them.
"Oh, you've misunderstood me dreadfully," she exclaimed, taking Miss Sarah's poor, piteous hands. I never dreamed you would think I was trying to, it was just because I thought you would like to have all those interesting details about your splendid father. I never dreamed of showing or telling that other little item to anyone. I didn't think it was of the least importance, and I never will."
There was a moment's silence. Then Sarah freed her hands gently, put her handkerchief to her eyes, and sat down, with a faint blush on her fine, wrinkled face.
We have misunderstood you, my dear, and we've been abominable to you. Will you forgive us?"
Half an hour later, a half hour which nearly was the death of Rebecca Dew, the Mrs. Pringle went away. It had been a half hour of friendly chat and discussion about the non-combustible items of Andy's diary. And at the front door, Miss Sarah, who had not the least trouble with her hearing during the interview, turned back for a moment and took a piece of paper covered with very fine, sharp writing from her reticule.
"I had almost forgotten. We promised Mrs. McLean our recipe for pound cake some time ago,
Perhaps you won't mind handing it to her, and tell her the sweating process is very important, quite indispensable, indeed. Ellen, your bonnet is slightly over one ear. You had better adjust it before we leave. We were somewhat...